A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete!
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
All right, everybody, Comedians and Law fans, this is Alex Barnett. I'm joined by Matt Ritter. Hello, Matt.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're here for episode 55 of the Comedians at Law podcast, and we're very excited to be talking to you this week. Matt and I haven't been together on the podcast for a while, so this is a great reunion.
It's nice. You know, I mean, we've all been doing so many gigs. I apologize if my voice is a little down for the count. I was just in Montana for a comedy fest, and before that I was in San Fran for our big show up at Cobb's, which went amazingly well.
Yeah, that was fantastic. A big full house, and had some nice conversations with people out there. And then last week, this past week, on October 9th, Kevin, Joan Weisblatt, and I were at the Stress Factory in New Jersey, New Brunswick, New Jersey, for a very full house, great show. And then coming up, we've got a few things on the books, Matt.
Yeah, we have a packed calendar here, huh?
Yeah, we do. So October 29th, we're going to be out in New Jersey again, performing for the New Jersey Pro Bono Committee in concert with the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. That's at 7 o'clock, and tickets are still available, so people can contact us. The next night, we're going to be in New York on the Lower East Side at the Locktoberfest.
I like that, Locktober. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, that's sponsored by ESQ Spot. And then people should definitely put on their calendars to save the date, November 23rd, up in White Plains, New York. We'll all be at the White Plains Performing Arts Center. Matt included, he'll be coming in from the West Coast especially for this one.
You know it's a big deal if I'm flying all the way across country for it.
Absolutely. So that's going to be a good one. People should put that on their calendars again. November 23, 8 p.m. at the White Plains Performing Arts Center. But we should get going because we've got a lot of big news stories this week and a really special interview. So let's see. Without further ado, let's get right into the news.
Let's jump into the news.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
All right. Well, our first article this week, Matt, I know really tickled your fancy. A couple of deans, three deans in particular, have banded together to form a blog, start writing a blog, that airs the dirty laundry of law schools. And they claim it's with the intention of driving the national conversation about legal education.
Well, I think it's smart because, I mean, look, law schools are getting savage, right? And the voice is pretty one-sided.
Yes, so, yes.
You know, whether you agree with them or not with what they're doing – I mean, what other choice do they have? I mean, they're just going to sit there and take punch after punch?
Well, I particularly think they should. But just so people have the background, the three deans we're talking about are Southern Illinois Law Dean Cynthia Fountaine, Hastings Law Dean Frank Wu, and Dean Shea of the Dayton School of Law Dean Paul McGreal.
Frank Wu, I've read a bunch of his stuff. I think he's on Above the Law as well. He's a good writer.
Yeah, so it's an interesting blog, I think, for law students. But, I mean, I think other law deans and law schools are a little bit fearful of what might appear on this law blog, correct?
You know, and I think that is sort of has been sort of the old way of thinking in general about social media and the law. You know, yeah. I think there's this fear of, like, what are we going to put out there, you know? But I think at this point, like, you know, when you write a blog, you should be able to know, that, you know, what boundaries you want to put up. While at the same time, like, still informing and still connecting, you know? I mean, that line between dean and student is probably a lot grayer than it was when we went to law school.
I think that's probably right, given social media. But here's the thing. Because of our audience base, which largely consists of law students, although many lawyers as well, we're clued into the ideas that law school education is getting more expensive. People are claiming more and more often that it doesn't prepare people for the law, for their legal careers, and that there's a glut of lawyers coming out of law schools. And this blog, at least according to some of the comments on the blog, suggests that every day there's a new article that suggests law deans are nothing more than con artists. And that's a quote coming from the blog.
Right.
So, you know, what are your views? I mean, you're not that recent of a grad anymore. I mean, you're not an ancient grad like me.
I mean, I think you know how I feel. I think, you know, I'm not going to call law school a scam, but it's not a good investment anymore. It's just not.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Look, I like that these guys now have to sing for their supper, you know? I mean, the cost of skyrocketed. There's no reason for you to owe $150,000 to go to law school and learn no practical skills.
Right. Do you think that there's a possibility we could see that this kind of pressure is going to drive the price of law school downwards?
Well, I mean, that would make sense, right? In a normal economy where there's supply and demand, right, at this point we're getting to the point where I think the supply of law students is starting to dry up.
I would say that that's probably – well, I don't know if the supply is drying up, but I think fewer and fewer people are applying to law school than in the past couple of years. Let's say
right. I mean, I'm calling them the supply, but basically that's essentially the supply.
Right.
They are essentially the supply chain. And so you think, you know, in a well-functioning economy that there would be a race towards the bottom price-wise to snag up those students, much like in real estate.
Let me ask you this: do you think that the candid nature of the disclosures and discussions that these deans are putting out on the blogosphere might have the reverse effect of actually encouraging people to go to those schools because the students welcome their candor?
You know, I mean, I think it depends on the type of person you are as a student. You
right.
know what I mean? If you're the type of student that's like, I don't want my school reputation to potentially be besmirched by this wise ass law dean, then maybe I won't go there.
Right, but if you're somebody that says, I like the fact that they're telling me what's going on, I will definitely go there now. You might want to go.
Yeah. I mean, I still haven't seen a justification for why law school is so expensive, period, you know?
I agree with you. Let me ask you this. If you were coming out of college now, or if you had worked for a couple of years and you were considering going to law school, would you still go now?
Well, only if I could get into the same school I went to Penn. If I could get into Penn again, I don't know if I would, but if I could get in, I would still do it.
Yeah. Do you think that your Penn law degree continues to open doors for you now, as many years as you are out?
It's gotten me almost everything positive that I've had in my career, entertainment right, or otherwise.
Right. So you're like at Starbucks and you're like, can I have an extra shot of vanilla? And they're like, well, you went to Penn Law. Absolutely.
That's pretty much how my day goes. It's not far from the truth.
I can tell you that my law degree has the reverse effect on people, that when I tell them where I went to law school, they're like, I didn't even know they had a law school. I thought they just had a basketball team.
Well, you know what's you know what's funny about that is a comic that you and I both know. Yesterday in Montana, we were talking about you, and he said, oh, didn't he go to Brown for law school? And I just said yes, just because I knew that would make you feel good.
Well, I appreciate it.
Does Brown even have a law school?
No, Brown does not have a law school.
Okay, perfect.
Right, Brown. I'm going to tell people I went to Brown Law.
I think that actually most civilians, you could tell you went to Brown Law.
Right. Well, so the bottom line with this is, we in Comedians Law, we think what? That this blog is a good thing for the legal industry.
I think it's a great thing. I'm gonna try and get Frank Wu on the podcast.
That's a great idea. I would like to hear what he has to say about the blog and about its effect on the legal career. And you know, we had that professor earlier on our blog way back when, several of them who actually have said that law school is way overpriced and is not delivering the goods the way it ought to.
I don't think we've had it. We may have had a dean or assistant dean. I'm not sure if we have.
No, professors, not deans. We have not had deans yet.
The other thing is I'm curious because of Hastings, because a lot of them came to our show at Cobb's last week.
Oh, that would be interesting. Well, yeah. It would be good to get his take on it then.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on. We've got a second article that's also on a hot button issue. This one, I think, is a little more for the non-lawyers in our audience. Damon of his own TV show now. He was sued by a man who claims that Dr. Oz's insomnia cure left him lame. And it turns out the lawsuit was dismissed, but it's an interesting lawsuit nevertheless because it shows to what extent people may seek, you know, recompense or fame. We don't know what this man was actually seeking.
You know, I thought the best way to cure insomnia was to watch Dr. Oz. I actually thought that was for people who had trouble sleeping in the middle of the day.
Right. Well, it's possible. But apparently there was a special insomnia thing made with heated rice footsie. It's a pair of socks with uncooked rice that you stick in the microwave, you heat it up, you put it on your feet, and that helps you fall asleep. Of course, I guess if you put it on the popcorn setting, you burn your feet off.
Yeah, you generally shouldn't put your socks in the microwave. Right. I find.
I have other insomnia, relief remedies that I like. I like to just drink a couple of glasses of scotch.
That's the best insomnia relief that exists.
Right. I think so. But what's interesting is here is that, Dr. Oz is not this man's doctor.
No, he's a television host.
Right. He is a doctor. He has a license, a medical license, but he's not this man's doctor. He's not providing medical advice. He's offering suggestions that are just a cut above Rachel Ray saying you should put extra virgin olive oil on everything.
I think they're a cut below. But by the way, my grandma swears by Dr. Oz. Like I think I've seen her put her socks on after putting them in the microwave.
Do you think that so now what happens is people must go to their doctor and the doctor says, "Well, take aspirin," and the person says, "Well, no, I can't because Dr. Oz says aspirin's bad for you."
Here's the other thing, right? I would assume that there's a standards and practices lawyer for this show.
Yes.
And they've cleared everything that he can and cannot say.
Absolutely, I would think.
So, even if they were to let the suit go through, how is that, that's got to be on them or the insurance or whatever,
But I think the case was dismissed because for the very reasons we've pinpointed. Well, you more so than me because you went to a better law school. But the fact that, this guy's a television personality. Yeah. He's not providing medical advice.
I mean, that's almost like watching Grey's Anatomy and then suing them.
Right. I mean, it's an absurdity.
That's basically the same thing.
Right. So the question is, like, what are people thinking? I mean, is this guy think he's going to get his own reality show because he sued Dr. Oz?
Maybe. Suing Dr. Oz, following Dr. Oz, the follow-up show. But, I mean, look, most of the people who watch Dr. Oz are old people who live at home, I think.
Well, this guy was quite elderly or mature, let's say. He was – I think it was – I want to say 76. Yeah, 76.
What does he have to lose at that point?
Well, apparently his feet.
Right, yeah.
Burn them.
By the way, I would be really creeped out to ever use the microwave if I saw somebody putting their socks in it.
The funny thing is, I have heard of putting socks filled with rice into the microwave as a way to, massage yourself, but not to fall asleep with hot socks on your feet.
It's very bizarre. If anything, you should sue Dr. Oz for aggressive eyebrow, unshaved, unkempt eyebrows.
Yeah, Dr. Oz is a little manscaped.
Yeah, it's an intentional infliction of emotional distress looking at that guy's face. It's very jarring.
Yes, I would say that's true. Look, obviously this guy's lawsuit was dismissed. No one really took him seriously. But perhaps he has a further career in television as Dr. Oz's second banana.
That's right. He's going to play the Ed McMahon.
That's right. Well, let's turn to our third article, which I think, or third news story, which is really interesting. And I know you could talk about this. This is there's an article in today's or this week's ABA Law Journal about law review articles are too long. And this is what critics are saying in a survey of literary people across the, or legal people, I should say, across the country. And I'm not sure why this is a news story. I could have told you that. Anybody who's ever read a law review article could have told you it was too long.
Well, nobody's ever read a full law review article.
Right, right. If it weren't for Lexis, I don't think anyone ever would look at them other than after they get published.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you on a journal at law school?
I was. I was on the Journal of International Economic Law, and I wrote like a 70-page treatise on why the Iraqi war is going to end up exactly like Vietnam.
Interesting. Were you right?
I think so.
Right. So, and it took you 70 pages to say what you just said in two sentences.
Right. I mean, you basically get it, right? I mean, I said it in two sentences and you get it and you're like, okay, yeah, that sounds right. I'm sure I had a lot of facts and history to back it up, but why the hell did they need to? I had to spend like 2 months on it.
Here's the other thing. Have you ever cited to a law review article in anything else you were writing?
I wanted to say definitely no, but I have to think about it for a second. No, definitely no. Definitely never.
See, and this is the interesting point, is that people go to such lengths like you did when you were an earnest law student writing your 70-page article, checking it, fact-checking it, putting footnotes, all this kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, no one is going to use it for anything beyond what you just did with it.
Yeah, and you know, somebody should mess around in the footnotes and put silly things in them just to see if anyone's paying attention.
I agree. I agree. Now, just for the audience, so you know, with the Comedians of Law fans, I was not on a journal. I was not a good enough law student to be knighted for a journal.
Did you apply?
No. In my school, it was based on grading, and you either graded on or you didn't. If you didn't grade on, your career further plummeted because we were already at a second or third tier law school.
Oof, yeah. So, not a lot of resume filler.
No. I was able to get out by saying I went to a law school that had one of the best basketball teams in the country.
At least that's a conversation piece. Does anybody really want to chat about the Journal of International Economic Law?
Only the people who work at the State Department.
Right, right. Like, if you want to get a job at the State Department, fine. But, like, if some lawyer is looking at your resume, does he really want to dive into that convo about my law review article?
But you know, that comes full circle to our first news story about the law blog airing the dirty laundry law schools. What you're saying is exactly on point. People, you know, each school has its own law review, the preeminent journal for the school, but then they have these other journals like the International Economic Law Journal. Do people really care?
They just exist because there are enough people that wanted to get on law review that didn't make it.
Right. So the point is, you have all these journals, even the law reviews.
Yeah.
People writing all these articles, and no one's reading them, and they never get thought about once they get published.
You know what people should do? You know what I actually did like at law school? The law review, like the theater groups.
Yes.
People should just say I was on law review and just leave it ambiguous as to whether it was the theater group or the 500-page treatise.
And in fact, you know what people ought to do? If they're in the law review, R-E-V-U-E, they ought to send us a clip of their best clip.
We could do that as part of our t-shirt contest.
Yes, I think as the Twitter contest, what I would like to see is everyone should send us by Twitter their best minute long clip from their law review, R-E-V-U-E.
And I like that.
Whichever is the best, we'll award the free t-shirt to.
I like that a lot. With that said, should we move on to Good Cop, Bad Cop?
Absolutely. All right, here we are, Good Cop, Bad Cop this week. I don't know. I assume you're the bad cop because you're definitely more stringent than I am. I'm too much of a softy. But I'm looking at our Twitter feed to see what came in over the transom this week. And sure enough, I want to say that in fairness to the bad cop, nobody did the hashtag CalPod this week.
I mean, these people are really getting my goat here.
Yeah, they haven't done it. Now, I will say on the flip side, on the good cop side, we've got two new followers just in the last 3 hours.
Oh, nice. Who are that?
Yeah. So that's Chase, who's a Texas A&M law student, and Evans Ochiang, who is he's not even a law student. He calls himself an art enthusiast. But, you know, I respect that. So here's the point. The bad part is we're not getting the kind of engagement from our fans that we thought. But at the same time, we're getting a lot of followers. We're getting a lot of people who are retweeting our stuff.
Yeah, I see somebody named Emily Jefferson just started following us.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting a lot of new followers. And we should give a shout out to Julie Katakis, who's really running our Twitter feed these days.
And by the way, Mr. Bernard, who's one of our most avid listeners, I apologize for there was a snafu on the tardiness of our podcast last week.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We should tell him that. In fact, I will reply to him right now to tell him that. But we're getting a lot of followers. Julie is really running the podcast. Also, Matt Storrs is helping us run a Twitter campaign. So they're really pulling the laboring oar on this. But we're not getting the engagement we need. And Bad Cop, what do you make of this?
You know what? I think maybe people think that we're not going to engage with them. I don't know. Maybe they can't think of any good questions to send us. I don't know. Do we need to have them send us? Are we not sending good things? Is it not? I think the law review thing will be good.
Well, that's what I think. I think ultimately that's what's really going to get us to the next place, is that we're going to put up this – we're going to have them – we're going to get them engaged by asking them to send us their stuff.
We got a bunch of new followers. Wow, this one looks – she looks very attractive. Christina Fernandez. Yikes. Hot stuff.
Well, there you go. I
see these other ones. There's a Sharky lawyer.
I'm telling you, we get a lot of followers, but they're not – they're following. They're being passive.
Yeah, followers are generally passive.
Yeah, so we need them to get more engaged.
Well, they will. Eventually, they will. They will come around.
But remember, so for next week's Twitter contest, what we want people to do is send us a clip from their own school's law review, REVUE.
Yeah,
best. Do not send us a copy of an article, right?
Yeah.
All right, and I think that's it for. So no T-shirt this week.
No, nobody deserved one.
I, as a good cop, I feel badly, but I have to say I agree with you.
But we got a great interview coming up, do we not?
We do. We have a really good interview. I was really pleased and privileged to be able to do this. A fellow comedian, good friend of mine, good friend of ours, comedian Mark DeMeo, is a former police officer in New York City, a former detective. He retired after 20 years on the force. He's a full-time comedian now. He's been on a bunch of things, Showtime. He's got a one-man show coming up in November in New York City for people who want to see that at the People's Improv Theater. So let's turn to that interview now. All right, everybody. This is Alex Barnett. I'm privileged today to be talking to a good friend of mine and a fellow comic, Mark DeMeo. And the interesting wrinkle about Mark and the relationship to the comedians of law is that Mark is a former New York City police officer who became a comedian. And we want to welcome Mark to the program. Welcome, Mark. Good to have you here.
What's up, Alex, man? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. We've been talking about having you on the show for a long time, so it's great to finally have you on. Well, listen, I think the people who are listening to the podcast, first thing they're going to know is tell us about being a cop and tell us about the transition from being a police officer to a comedian.
Okay. I was a New York City police officer for 20 years. I retired in June 2012, and June 30th, 2012, I did 20 years to the date. That's what's called doing 20 and out.
and that is to and what's the point of 20 and out? Is that to get the pension?
Absolutely. It's all about getting that. It's like getting the pension is like winning. I guess it's the lotto game. Win for life. $1,000 a week for life.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like. And you know the commercials where they started to call up. Now they're calling up the 911 and saying, "Oh, my husband cut his finger," and then she finally divulges that he's a win for life winner. So then they send the Secret Service and they send the FBI over to help him just to make sure he's okay, because he's a win for life. So that's me. Anything that happens to me, we got to make sure I'm okay.
Right. So now, originally, you are a New York citizen, born and bred in New York City, correct?
Yeah, I'm a New Yorker. I'm a native New Yorker.
Okay. And you're on the New York City police force, and people are going to want to know. So tell us, were you a detective? Were you a beat cop? What were you doing there?
I was a cop for 7 years. Then I got promoted to being a detective, and I was a detective for 13 years. I worked in the first place I worked as a detective was in the Warren Squad, which was actually like a really, really cool place to work. If you fail to go back to court in New York City on a felony, the judge issues a warrant for your arrest. Our job was to hunt that person down and bring him back to justice. Damn it, and it was fun.
That's excellent.
Then in the middle of all the fun that we were having, we got a new police commissioner, Ray Kelly. He wasn't a big fan of warrants. Plus, the detective squads were short manpower. And the detective squads is really the backbone of the detective bureau. So they started basically shipping us out into detective squads. And then I was there in the detective squad for 5 years. That kind of sort of sucked. Being a detective in a detective squad is like watching NYPD Blue, the one with the Sipowitz, Barney Miller. It's not like CSI at all. Like Law and Order, I think on Law and Order they're homicide detectives because they're always investigating homicides. But it's not like CSI. I mean, you're really doing the work. Yeah. That's like the biggest misconception. I don't know how CSI works in other states and other municipalities, but in New York City, CSI, our crime scene unit, they show up if I'm the catching detective, which means that I was working in the squad in that precinct, and there was a homicide, I tell them what to do. Thus, yeah. Is get DNA off of that, voucher this. They're basically listening to everything. They could have suggestions for me to also, do you want me to collect this?
Right.
At the end of the day, all that evidence comes back to me, and I figure out who the killer is. Not CSI. CSI doesn't come with me to help me catch the bad guy.
Yeah.
It's all on the squad guy.
Did you, now were you a homicide detective or a robbery detective?
I wasn't a homicide detective. I used to, when I was in the squad, I mostly investigated robberies and burglaries.
Okay. And were you assigned to a high crime area or a lower crime area?
I was in Harlem. Harlem at the time was, you know, well, I worked in the 2-6 mostly. And the 2-6, which is in Harlem on the west side from 110th to 140th Street, from the water until... I think it's Lennox or Powell.
So for people who don't know New York, that's Columbia University plus points north to Sugar Hill, correct?
Oh, my God. There's six colleges in there. You got Manhattan School of Music. You got Barnard. You got Columbia. You got City College. And I'm missing a few.
Yeah, yeah. So you did that for 13 years at being a detective, part of the warrant squad and then being assigned out, catching criminals, doing that stuff. Did you like it? Did you love it? Did you hate it?
I like being in the warrant squad. That was good because for what I wanted out of the job, it was perfect for me. The detective squad was a lot of work. You know, when they talk about or make jokes about how much paperwork is involved in being a detective, they're not kidding.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more work than I really wanted to do.
Right.
But, you know, I stuck it out. I did my 5 years. And then I wound up luckily getting out of there. I went to work for the chief of detectives, and that was an instructor. I basically was a teacher. I used to train the detectives, OSHA and EEO and whatever nonsense that we have people, detectives have to be trained in twice a year.
Yeah, yeah. So at what point did you start doing comedy while you were still a working police officer?
I started out acting almost immediately when I got on the job. I got on the job, and I realized like almost right then in the beginning of the academy that, you know, this it was just going to be a job. I wasn't going to make it like an adventure. I always said there's two types of people who become cops: people who have a calling and people who messed up on their SATs. I got 700 on my SAT.
Okay.
And I thought it was a great grade, by the way. I had a friend that told me you get 600 points for signing your name right. And I told him, if you take away the 600 points, I still got 100. So there. Needless to say, all the college letters weren't coming in the way I originally anticipated.
Yeah, yeah. So you started acting right out of the academy, or even in the academy.
Yeah, I started. I got to my first precinct, and then I says, all right, I got this job now because I was married. And I married a Greek girl, a very beautiful girl that I'm still married with 24 years later. And I wanted to prove to her family that I wasn't a loser. And so I got this it's a decent job, you know. At least we're going to get some health insurance, and we're going to get a steady salary. And I couldn't very easily just quit that now to become an actor.
Yeah.
But I kind of figured I'll do the acting until I become famous. And 20 years later, I was eligible for retirement.
Right. Almost famous at that point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Almost famous. But I started doing comedy probably – I've been doing it 16 years. So somewhere in my fifth year of being a cop.
Yeah. Now, yes. How did you balance that? Because I know from my own profession, being a lawyer, was very hard to balance actually being a very active lawyer by day and then performing comedy at night. How did you work being a police officer by day and comedian by night?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because when I was working, I always found a way. I used to work my job 8 hours. I used to do a couple of hours overtime. I'd coach my son's baseball team, and then I'd do comedy at night. And I would do this 5 nights a week at least. And then now that I'm retired, if I have one thing to do the next day, it drains my mind mentally. The night before, Did I just say drain my mind mentally? What am I, an idiot? It drains me physically just thinking about what the one thing I have to do the next day. If I have to go to the bank, all I could think about the day before is, wow, man, I got to get my car out, and I got my dog, and I have to take a shower. Man, I can't believe it.
Right, right. No, I can understand that. It's exactly the way it is. The busier you are, the more you get done.
You know what I miss? I'll tell you the truth. When you work and you have a job, and the best feeling you could ever have when you have a job is taking care of your personal stuff on job time.
Yes,
you know what I'm saying? Like if you can get it to a doctor's office on job time, you are winning. Like you just feel like $1 million. You're letting other people pass you. You're like, no, go ahead. I got time. You got to get out of here. Go ahead. No, I'll go next.
Right.
You know.
So now, as this was progressing, your career was progressing, your police officer career and your comedy career, was there a point at which you decided, look, I like comedy more than acting, or I want to balance the two?
I immediately knew that comedy, I loved acting too, but as soon as I started doing comedy, I just knew. And I never thought I'd make the 20 years because things were going good in comedy. But it was never really good enough to say goodbye to the annual salary,
yeah,
and to the health benefits. And thank God I didn't, you know, because the economy changes. I mean, there was a time where, I don't know how long you've been doing comedy.
7+ years, yeah.
All right, when I was doing comedy 7+ years, I remember if somebody called me up and asked me if I was available to do a gig on a Saturday night for $250, I'd probably, I don't know, because I was really holding out for $4.
Yeah. Right.
I used to get $4, $4.50 to do a gig.
Right, you know, that's on the road, though. That's on the road, right?
Yeah. I mean, not even that far out. Going to Jersey, Connecticut, that was just the running thing. It was like $400, $450 for one gig.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And now somebody's calling you up for $250. You're like, where, when, why? I'm on my way. You know what I'm saying? So
right.
A lot of it has to do with the economy. And, it, you know, thank God I stuck it through because right now right now, you know, even with the retirement, the pension, and the money I make from comedy, it's still not enough. I got teenage kids, you know, and, you know, it's just not, I need money.
Right, I hear you.
Did you pay for this, by the way?
What's this? Did you pay for this? Yeah, we'll pay you in free legal services from a bunch of lawyer comedians.
I have a legal question for you later on. I'll ask you that.
All right. So here's the thing. I know that you've done actually quite well for yourself in comedy. Why don't you tell? I mean, you've had some really serious credits. Tell us about what you've done already. I know you're on Showtime, and you've got some other big credits.
The first credit that I had that was probably pretty big was. I forget whether it was Showtime's White Boys in the Hood. I was on that. I also did the Latino Laughter. I went out to L.A. to film 2 seasons of that. I did his Comedy Central stand-up 360. I just taped Gotham Comedy Live. In between there, it's hard for me to remember right now, but there's been a bunch of other stuff. I've done Talking Heads things like for MTV and for VH1. So every year I get a couple of things, you know, spots on TV, but it's never been anything that to catapult me over the, you know, to the other side, the right. Other side where I can, you know, piss on people. Which
right. Now, do you ever get the itch? Because I, you know, as a fellow comedian, I know that sometimes the business can be very frustrating. Do you ever get the itch to, like, go back to being a cop so you can shoot somebody legally?
No. I mean, I would never go back to being a cop. I mean, I'm done with that part of my life. I'm lucky I get out on skate. You know what I'm saying? I never shot anybody. I never had to shoot anybody. I never tell people that, by the way. People always ask you, did you ever shoot anybody?
Right.
And I never say no. What I say is I'd rather not talk about it.
Right.
Because say no, you just became the most boring person in the room. People get upset at you. Like, how could you be a cop for 20 years and not shoot anybody?
Right. Now, but actually this came up when we did a show together recently where, you know, we were talking about hecklers getting out of hand and things having, you know, issues arising. Was there ever an issue when you were still an active police officer where like a fight broke out in a bar or a club when you were performing and you felt like some weird obligation to step in as an off-duty police officer? No.
I have to say that. Actually, the reality is, you know, you're in a bar, you're in a nightclub. There's always somebody getting thrown out, somebody getting bounced out. I don't know if you remember the Times Square Arts Center, do you?
Sure, yeah.
You know, that was right in the middle of Times Square, and they were attracting a shady crowd. You know, whoever was walking by the club, that's where the barkers would get their people in from. And that midnight show was, there was some real thugs in there.
Yeah.
And they came close. And, you know, I'm like, not only am I a cop, but I'm always the biggest dude there, too, because I'm 6'4". And I was like 250 at the time. So people always expect me to get involved. And to tell you the truth, nobody understands that I'm the only person who can't get involved. And, you know, luckily nothing ever happened. Nothing ever got, you know, carried away where there was actually a crime committed in front of my house, in front of my face, and I had to take police action. It was always just a question over the bill and a lot of arguing and
back
and forth and stuff like that.
Right. So now, fast forward, you're a retired police officer, you're collecting your pension, which isn't enough to feed your growing teenagers who are shopping and eating and doing all kinds of good teenager stuff. What's going on with what are you doing now that's really exciting you about the comedy work you're doing?
Well, I've been working on this one-man show. It's called 20 and Out, like I mentioned at the top of the show. And it's about my whole experience as a cop, the whole 20 years, how I became a cop, what was it like, and then what am I doing now? And I'm doing it, the first time I'm putting it up is at the Pit, which is the People's Improv. Is it the People? Yeah, the People's Improv Theater.
That's right.
And I'm doing it November 10th at 5 p.m. It's the first time I'm putting it up. And it's only going to get better from then. We're going to tinker it and tool it, and hopefully it'll be on Broadway one day. I mean, that's the goal.
That's great. So are tickets available yet, or are they going to be available at some point? Or
absolutely. It's called Solo Con Comp Weekend, S-O-L-O-C-O-M. And it's a whole weekend of one-man shows and some one-person sketches and things of that nature. Some spoken word, all original works, all brand new. So Solo Com, and it's the weekend of November 9th and 10th, and it's at the Pit.
Okay, and do you have a website where people can get tickets, or should you go to the Pit website?
Yeah, markdemayo.com. It's markdemayo.com. And I don't have the tickets just yet, but I could get them for you. I could at least make a reservation, give you the number to make a reservation.
Yeah.
And then start promoting it like this week probably.
That's great. That's great. So now do you think that once this gets going, you're going to shift your focus from doing straight stand-up to focusing solely on the one-man show, or are you going to do both at the same time?
I'll always do stand-up because I like writing jokes, but I'm writing a lot more now. And so I like it to have an outlet to you know, to do something that's maybe not so punched up, maybe not so, you know, every 30 seconds a laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, story.
Right. Now, are you working with a director? Is there someone directing you for the one-man show?
I'm looking for a director right now. I have somebody in mind. I just, I'm going to ask him, basically, and see how much he charges.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's see. Let me wrap up a little bit here because we got time's running short. What are you doing in the next, other than the one-man show, where are you going to be performing, let's say, mid-October through till the end of November that you want people to come see you?
Well, tomorrow night I'm doing Dangerfields and The Stand. So tomorrow night would be Thursday night. I'll be at Dangerfields 8:25 and at The Stand at 11. And then Friday and Saturday you can catch me at the Eastville, which is on 4th Street and 2nd Avenue. And on Sunday I'm at the Eastville. I'm also at LOL. Okay. And I also have my schedule of my appearances is on my website, markdemayo.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm there. I'm out there, man. I'm so freaking out there.
I know that you are. And by the way, for everyone listening, I've worked with Mark, I don't know how many times now. The dude is hilarious. And I'm not just saying that because he's much bigger than me. He's actually very funny.
So are you, Alex, man. So are you. Very, very funny.
Thank you. Thank you. But no, I mean, I always enjoy working with you. It was real fun to work with you and Kevin the other day over at Bananas. And I hope that we get to work together again soon. So I'm going to let you go wrap up. Just stick around with us one more second, Mark, as we go off the air and we go back to our podcast.
All right.